Hi everyone, I'm Rebecca. I'm going to check the volume. Do I need to speak louder? We're good. Everyone, for those of you who don't know, I am in a cover band, and so there's some people in this room who are teasing me and telling me they wanted me to sing. I am not. I wouldn't even know what to sing, but, First of all, I want to thank Anne-Marie and Jim for the introduction. I didn't expect this to be such a large group today. I've told my story before in action once, and that was like 10 years ago. I got to tell my story at a Saturday morning CA meeting. It was like a thing where, you know, they kind of like God picked the short speaker before the long speaker talks, and they were like, "It's you!" And I was like, "Really?" And at that time, I had not ever heard of an Al-Anon person speaking at a CA meeting, and I checked tonight and said, like, "Have you really done this before?" And they were like, "Yeah, like a really long time ago, yeah, I was in my life." And I was like, I think this group is just amazing. Like, you guys, when I showed up, I was dating dude, and you made me feel so welcome right away. Like, everybody just came up, big hugs, they were just so happy to see me, and so I know I don't need to be nervous or afraid, because I have always felt very loved by the people here. And I'm so grateful for all of you, and I will try to be brief so I can say more about that at the end. And I also want to say props to Anne-Marie. She's never even been to one of these, and they're like, "Will you introduce Rebecca?" She's like, "Yeah!" And that's one of the things that I am super grateful for, too. God knew that I was not going to pick a sponsor who seemed like, you know, the nice lady who was, like, floating on sunshine and light all the time. And so, fortunately, like, she's got an edge to her, too. Don't be fooled by the, you know, the sweet voice. But she's also an extremely positive, "Yes, I'll try it" kind of person, and that's something that I really admire, and that's who I want to be when I grow up. So I'm just very grateful for Anne-Marie. So anyway, I'll tell my story now. You know what's weird? I'm sleepy today. Like, a lot of my story is actually my parents' story, so I'll try not to tell that part of the story. I will just tell you that there is a history of alcoholism on one side of the family. The other side of the family, there's a history of mental illness, actually. There was drug abuse in my home when I was a very small child. I do not remember much about that. I'm grateful that I don't remember more. A lot of what I know about that time, first of all, came up as stories of, like, hilarious family lore. One of the stories involves, we had a footbridge behind my house when I was a small child, and the kindergarten class from the local elementary school would come over to play Billy Goat's Rough, like, act out the story. And the year that my class came, of course, it was my backyard, so my mother invited the class, you know, to our backyard, and I was invited to show them our vegetable garden. So there's me, 5-year-old me, saying, "Well, this is beans, and these are peas, and these are carrots, and that's my daddy's pipeweed, and that's corn." Right? And the weird thing is, like, that story, people would tell that story, like, in the family, we'd all laugh, because drugs and alcohol weren't the problem. We kind of had an elephant in the room in my family, and it wasn't. We had an elephant, We talked about it all the time, but we called it a zebra, okay? Because my loved one or my parents got sober by attending a very conservative church, and that was how they managed to get sober. And I today am so grateful for those people because I got to grow up with my dad. But at the time, it was a very difficult thing in our family because my mother wanted nothing to do with that community, and also too, you know, and they talk about this a little bit in the big book. If you ever read the part for the wives, where they, you know, the where they have some talk about when the person starts going to meetings and the alcoholic gets sober, they talk about how he might start to come and get more involved in the family when he wasn't involved before. And so there were a lot of issues in our home about, you know, parents suddenly disagreeing about how kids were being raised when before it was all up to one parent. I had a parent who was suddenly dressing differently, talking differently, gone all the time, but for a different reason than before, and it was very confusing for me. I also was getting a lot more stories about, here's what was happening before, probably more than I needed to know, and, you know, Dad was a bad guy before, now Dad's a good guy, and I was like, that's weird, because I liked you better before. it was just hard. And so anyway, I also got a lot of messages around that time about, you know, you can join this religious community over here, and you're going to have to change a lot, because you don't measure up. Or you can not join that religious community, and you get to save yourself, but you might go to a hot place, you know. And that was really tough for my 9-year-old mind to understand. And so what I started to do was I had some academic talent, I was good at school, and I just became a kid that was beyond the reproach of any adult. I just became a perfect model child as well as I possibly could. So I think I just got perfect grades, and I was, you know, I do sports and like perfect, like I was the most coachable kid ever. Like, you know, like you tell me to jump how many times and how high. Like, I was going to do it just right. And I got really hooked on that kind of success and achievement. And by the time I was in high school, I was just running so fast, I didn't even have time to feel. I was just doing so that I'd be okay, so I would feel like I was okay. And to make people happy with me, because there was a lot of conflict in the family around the religion stuff. And so, you know, going on in my adulthood, I just kind of like stumbled around trying to get one achievement after another to try to make myself feel like I was good enough, I think. And that's kind of the crux of it. I had a friend who, I don't know if any of you knew him, his name was Gary P. And I remember after I got into the program, had a long conversation with him once on the phone. And he was kind of like the Riddler. Like, I don't know if you guys know anybody, like an old-timer in program who's like the Riddler. They're like, you know the answer. You're like, no, I really don't know what you want me to say right now. They're like, no, come on, you know. And that's what he would do. And he finally asked me, he's like, what's the deal? What is your issue? And I said, I never felt good enough. Just popped out. So, you know, I mean, I would go around and I would, you know, like, kind of be a workaholic and never dated anybody for more than 2 months. I moved all the time. From the time that I was 18 until about 31, I think I moved once a year. I probably changed careers once every 3 years. Not kidding. Like, I used to I eventually settled on being a school teacher, and students were just amazed at how many different jobs I had. They were like, what? You used to do what? I was like, I used to drive semi-trucks. They're like, what? And that just went on and on and on. And then finally I decided it's time that I learned how to date like a normal person. So, you know, of course, that would mean online dating. And I mean, I could tell you some really amazing stories about that. But because I didn't know what I was doing, you know, just trying to fake it. And then I met this guy online, and this guy really liked me right away. And usually if somebody liked me right away, I was like, there must be something wrong with you, right? No. But I had decided that I was gonna just not, this time I wasn't gonna just run. And so I hung around for a while, and I really did start to like him very much, and he was talking about the future, like, way too early, but I didn't know that, because I didn't know how to date anybody, and I'd only been around anybody for a couple of weeks before I just bailed, so I was like, well, maybe this is how it happens, maybe you just finally meet that right person, and then everything's going to be fine, you're going to be happy, and life all falls into place, it's all good. And that was not the way it went. He had a tendency to disappear. That was his thing. He would be like, we'd make plans for the weekend, and then he wouldn't show up, and I could not get him on the phone. And that went on for a couple of months, and I finally confronted him about that, and he said, well, I have this problem with, you know, cocaine, and now that I met you, I am absolutely sure that I can beat this thing. And I was like, yeah, I can help you with that. Because that is what we do. I have some nice Al-Anon friends who came by to support me tonight, and they're like, yeah, that's what we do. You know, and the family thought I could fix things too, so I was like, yep, I could fix your son. So we, you know, we set up a daily call time, because that was going to solve the problem. So, you know, 3 o'clock or 3:30, you know, he would call, tell me he was okay, and I'd be like, great. And if I got the call, all was right with the world. And if I did not get the call, then I'd start blowing up his phone. And if it got to be 9 o'clock at night, I'd be just sick with worry. And if it got to be, like, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and there still wasn't a voicemail, I wouldn't be able to go back to sleep, and I was just sick with dread all the time that the next time the phone rang, someone was going to call and tell me that he was dead. And I did that for a little while until he got into a rehab program, and the counselors there told me to go to Al-Anon, which I didn't know what it was. I thought, okay, so this is when they're going to teach me how to get him sober. They're going to teach me the do's and don'ts, right, so that I can help fix him. And so I showed up at the first meeting, and they told us the 3 C's of Al-Anon. And the 3 C's of Al-Anon, for those of you who probably haven't heard them, maybe you have, are that we can't control it, we didn't cause it, and we can't cure it. And that made a lot of sense to me. That made so much sense. I was like, of course there's nothing I can do about him. He's not my problem anymore. Awesome! Okay, but then, of course, the very next thought was, why didn't I think of that by myself? And why am I at an Al-Anon meeting? Oh, I'm the problem, right? And so I spent the next couple of years trying to figure out how not to be my problem. He and I didn't work out in those days, and I had to go try and be by myself, which I was good at, actually. I've done that for a really long time. I learned some things about the people. Well, first of all, I was furious that I had to go to these meetings. I didn't trust anybody. I'd had experiences with, you know, other groups that weren't great. And so, you know, I kind of showed up and was like, I just want to learn what I need to learn so I can get the hell out of here.
I'm not here to make friends. Oh, lost
someone. Oh, that was weird.
Oh, nope.
Uh-oh. not here to make friends. I'm just going to, you know. But here's the one thing. My attitude was terrible. But the one thing I did right, I think, maybe my sponsor would disagree, and I'm not sure. Oh, you did a lot of things wrong, Rebecca. The one thing I did right is I decided that I was not going to go to those meetings and then lie. So if I was going to talk, I was going to tell the truth the way I understood it. That is the one thing that I did that I think saved me and helped me. Because if I had something to say, I tried to tell the truth. And I will tell you, there were times when I thought I had said something very witty, clever, and funny, and nobody laughed. And there were times when I said something that I thought was quite serious, and the whole room laughed. And they did weird things, like they go around and they say things like, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon," and my attitude was like, "You people are really sick. How could you be grateful for this?" And it went on and on there. I was doing all my sponsor told me because I had no better ideas. Anne-Marie came later, that was somebody else. But she was kind of bossy, and she'd tell me to do this weird stuff, and I'd be like, "That doesn't make sense." And she'd be like, "Get on your knees and say this prayer every morning," and I'd be like, "I don't believe that prayer." And she said, "I don't care, do it anyway." And I really didn't have any better ideas. So I just did what she told me to, and then I'd tell her why it was going to work. So I'd call her up, and then she'd say things like, "Hey, I think you kind of have the hee-hees." And I'd be like, "What do you mean?" And she'd be like, "Because every sentence that you say over the phone to me starts with he. So maybe you should talk about you, and I want to hear about he all the time." And then I'd call up, and I'd say, "Do you know what he did?" You know, and she would tell me to make a gratitude list, and I didn't want to make a gratitude list, and then I'd hang up the phone and make that gratitude list, and I felt better, and I was mad, and she was right. That's what I was like. And the people in the Al-Anon meetings just smiled and said, "Keep coming back." You know, they told me to keep coming back, and I did, because I didn't have any better ideas. And then this one time, my bossy sponsor, not that one, the other one, told me that I had to go to Green Lake or the AA Roundup or whatever it was. And I didn't want to go. And I was supposed to go with a friend so I couldn't isolate and hide, and I didn't want to do that either. And she said, "Fine, you can drive by yourself, but you have to make an appointment to go for a walk with somebody in your group, like someone who you know." So I did that because she wouldn't leave me alone. And when I was done, I kind of had this really nice walk with this lovely lady named Chris, and we chatted, and I was driving home from that event because I wasn't going to stay up for nights. And I had this feeling, this peaceful feeling, thinking about the people in Al-Anon and thinking about some of the stuff that they've been sharing in meetings. There was this lady in the meetings who was the most gentle, beautiful soul you could tell. And she shared in a meeting that she used to scream and throw dishes at people. And I didn't think she would lie about that, because that wasn't a very flattering thing to say about yourself. And I also could tell that there's no way she was like that anymore. So somehow this stuff was helping her. She changed, she'd gotten better. And I started to think that if maybe those people were able to get better, that I could get better. And then I started thinking some more about how brave it was for some of them to show up at our meetings, because, you know, even though I had the hee-hees, the people in my meetings did not have the hee-hees. They were talking about themselves. They would say, "This horrible thing happened in my household, and here's what I'm going to do about it. Here's what I did wrong. Here's what I need to change so that I can feel better." They were taking responsibility for themselves. And I realized on that drive home from that retreat how brave that was. And I realized that the people of Al-Anon are heroes. and that I had been arrogantly thinking that somehow I was better than them and I wasn't going to need them anymore. And I fell in love with them on that drive home because I thought maybe if I hung around with them long enough, maybe I could be a hero too. And so I just kept going to meetings and did some step work, a lot of step work. I did a marathon 4-step. She knows. Yeah, she knows. If you're ever getting mired in your 4-step, my advice to you, this is what someone did with me. I had an accountability partner. So I had a friend who also was dying from her 4-step, and we decided to, you know, go to each other's houses and, hey, you will not talk to me for the next 20 minutes. We're both just going to write. And we got it done. Yeah. That was kind of cool. So anyway, what happened finally was, dude joined Facebook. And I got a friend request from Jude. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and she didn't think it was a very good idea for me to answer that friend request. But he owed me an amends. So I accepted the friend's request. Which is so sick and crazy now, but that's the one time sick and crazy actually kind of works out for me. So anyway, so I accept this friend request, and I got the amends. Maybe a week or two later, and you know what? I thought it sucked. I was like, really? That's all I get? Like, I had put so much on, like, this is going to make it all okay. Like, the amends is going to just make it fine now, and it didn't, and to this day, I'm still like, what was I expecting? Like, honestly, he gave a very appropriate amends. He owned his stuff, and he did not own stuff that was not his stuff. But I wanted him to own everything, of course. And so, you know, I don't know, but maybe I wanted the amends to say something like this. I know that I was supposed to show up, sweep you off your feet, and allow you to live happily ever after without doing any work whatsoever. But instead, I blew up your entire life, and I will be eternally sorry for that. Like, I don't know. Is that what I wanted? He did not blow up my entire life. I did. Because I gave my will and my life over to the care of an untreated addict. That's what I did. And so it wasn't until I started getting my priorities right that my life started to change. And change they did. So I started to friend, I think I answered something about the amends. Like, gee, thanks. That's really helpful. and then we started chatting, and he said, hey, do you want to meet up and go out for dinner? And so this is the end of my story. I'm not talking too long. For those of you who are like, oh, God, there's an Al-Anon speaker? Get to the addict. Just so you know, I feel that way, too, when I'm at these. I'm always like, come on. When's the addict coming up? So we meet up for dinner, and he's telling me, like, you know, because it's been like 4 years, like, what happened? And he's sober now, and he's telling me the whole thing, and it's, you know, we're talking about that stuff. And this is hilarious. We're at this little, like, restaurant, and the tables were kind of close together, and there's this older couple who's sitting really close to us, like, as close as you guys are to me. They did not say a word to each other the entire meal. Because I think they were listening to us. Telling the whole thing, like, yeah. So we go for a walk afterwards, and at some point he says to me, I am really sorry that you had to go to Al-Anon because of me. And I started telling him about how I found out once I went to Al-Anon that I'd actually had a really long history of dating people who abused drugs and alcohol. And I found out, I learned more about how I'd never felt good enough, and I had always kind of felt like this faithless rat when it came to my higher power, who would barely tolerate me, and now instead I was learning from people in Al-Anon that I was a child of God, and that I, that God was rooting for me, was on my side, and how different it felt to live life that way. And as I was telling him all these things, we came up to this little pond, and we'd been walking in a park, and there were these two little ducks swimming around the pond. And he said to me, "You see those two little ducks? They were mallard ducks." So I don't know if you're familiar, but mallard ducks are kind of funny because the male and the female look like different ducks. The male has green feathers on his head, and the female doesn't have green feathers on her head. She's just brown and speckly. So you don't know. They don't look like they're the right ducks. Like, they don't look like a couple. Let's put it that way. And he said to me, even though they don't look alike, those two ducks are really the same kind, and they belong together. And I thought that was really smooth. No, I went for that, you know. And you guys, most many of you know the rest of the story because, you know, you held our kids at meetings when they were babies. You guys, you know, were with us through getting engaged and getting married and having our two little children. And I will tell you, there are times when I forget what a lucky scamp I am. But I don't forget what you guys have done for my family. Because without the people in this room and the people in some of the Al-Anon rooms, there are two little beautiful children who do not exist. And I am not kidding. I mean that 100%. It's because God worked through the people in this room. And I will never stop being grateful for you guys helping to save my husband's life and giving me the family that I have. And with that, I will pass.